Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers, developers, and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, who gives you innovation training your customers will love you for. Get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, Everyday Innovators. I love getting high-quality recommendations for a guest interview, and that's why we have the guest we have today. I got a great recommendation. I'm talking about product innovation with someone who's been a startup co-founder, a CEO, and now helps product teams build habit-forming products. He is also the author of the book Hooked, which tells how to create products that captures the attention of consumers and creates better engagement. Nuriel, welcome to the Everyday Innovator, and thanks for helping me and the listeners understand how to build products that hook customers.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, glad you're here. So, you know, looking at your profile, many sides to you, business person, human expert, behavior expert, engaging speaker, dad, just to name a few. I'm curious, where did your interest to deeply understand human behavior first begin? Because I know also as a dad, my interest in human behavior has increased dramatically since my first child was born, and I haven't figured out too much. But I suspect there you have some other contributing factors too.
Yeah, so you know, my interest kind of started from my profession. I've started two companies, and the last one was in the intersection of gaming and advertising. And at the intersection of those two industries, I got to see a lot of experiments done. I got to see a lot of trial and error, both with my advertising clients as well as the gaming companies that we worked with. And you know, if I'm honest here, I'll admit that gaming and advertising are two industries that are really dependent on mind control. Right? Those advertisers don't spend those billions of dollars for their health. They do it because it makes people buy the things they're selling. And the same with gaming companies, that game companies are experts, are masters of manipulating human motivation to keep people playing and playing their games. So it was at the intersection of those two industries that I learned so much about what drives human behavior, but not from the psychology standpoint, but from the application of these techniques. You know, I was in the field, kind of in the trenches, watching these products work, and sometimes they would work and sometimes they wouldn't. And what I found was interesting is that people in these two industries didn't necessarily know why these techniques work. They just know that they did work, right? Mm-hmm. So they would do what their competitor was doing and is doing successfully, or they would do what was done before that succeeded, but they didn't know the underlying psychology around why these techniques were so effective. And so after I left those two industries, I still had a big open question mark about, you know, why certain games and certain ads persuaded people and why others didn't. And so I took some time off after my last company was acquired, and I decided to do what I really love doing, which is to write and research. And I spent a lot of time at the Stanford Graduate School of Business Library, and I talked to a lot of experts in the field. A lot of them I knew from professional experience, but then I met a lot of academics. And I tried to kind of connect the dots in writing a book that could be a how-to manual for how to help your users do the behaviors that you'd like them to do in the hopes that you're creating healthy habits for them, that you're helping them live better lives. But for want of these products being poorly designed or suboptimally designed, customers aren't able to do the behaviors you want them to do. Mm-hmm. So I really wrote the book that I was looking for, a manual for consumer psychology, so that you can, you know, make more money, so that you can help people live better lives by building products better.
Good. And the book that really helps us figure out why sometimes we're successful in engaging customers more and sometimes we're not. Right. And I had a similar experience in developing products. I just got fascinated about why we really do a good job understanding users' requirements sometimes and deliver what they want, and sometimes we don't. And instead of hanging out at the Stanford Library, I went back and did the PhD work. And I think you probably had a better path, actually. But but I'm glad with how it turned out.
I hacked it together a little bit.
Excellent. So let's provide a little context then for your Hooked model. Because when it comes to this concept of hooking customers, you know, creating these user habits with your product, what types of products are we talking about?
So it's products that require repeat engagement. And specifically, not only repeat engagement, they require unprompted engagement. So there's lots of ways to get people to use your product. You can engage them with advertising. You can engage them with search engine optimization. Heck, you know, you can open up a physical storefront on the street corner to get people to engage with your business. Mm-hmm. However, there's a certain type of company that depends upon what's called unprompted user engagement. So people using the product on their own without relying on expensive advertising or spammy messaging, these products that bring people back on their own through their habits. So for example, if you think about companies like Facebook or Twitter or LinkedIn or WhatsApp or Instagram, right? Many of these tech products that we've seen create billions of dollars of value over the past few years, part of what makes them so valuable is that they don't have to do anything to bring people back. And in fact, if they had to pay for an ad to bring you back to Facebook every time, well, they'd go out of business, right? The model would break. It wouldn't work anymore if it relied on paying to bring people back. So these business models, the way that they create and deliver value, they depend upon people coming back on their own. And so if your listeners are building that type of business or would like to learn how to use consumer psychology in lots of different ways to increase customer retention, well, that's really what I focus on. That's been the crux of my research.
Yeah, excellent. Because some of the everyday innovators listening will be focused on the technology products where those unprompted user engagement experiences are really important. And others are focused on, you know, physical products from, you know, tooth whitening to roofing and all kinds of different products.
Let me just interject,
please address that.
The one thing I'd like to interject is even if your product doesn't require a habit, I mean, that's a very high bar. To get people to form habits is not easy work. I mean, there's not that many companies that can do it well. There's still a lot that can be learned from consumer psychology, which I think, you know, is something that everybody in business needs to understand. The more you can understand the mind of your consumer, the better you'll be able to address their needs. So you can actually utilize these principles piecemeal. And I'll describe the four steps of the hook model. But the hook model is if you have to form a habit, you have to have a hook. And so you have to have all four of these steps. But even if you don't need to form a habit, you can still learn from these techniques piecemeal and say, okay, how can I make the experience easier to use? How can I make it more rewarding? How can I bring people back by understanding how they behave? And interestingly enough, what's fascinating, what drives me to learn more about consumer psychology every day is that these are things that drive consumer behavior in ways that even your customer can't tell you will drive their behavior. It's what I call inarticulatable needs. Mm-hmm. So these are these biases, these heuristics that drive human behavior in a way that fascinatingly enough, we can't actually describe these techniques. We don't know they drive our behavior, and yet they predictably do change what we do every day.
Excellent. So this information is for any product teams, anyone developing products. There will be some nuggets here to grab a hold of, whether it's a technology product or other products, as we understand just human behavior.
Right.
Very good. So let's dive into that model then, your four-step hook model for building habit-forming products. Where do we begin with that?
Right. So every hook starts with a trigger. A trigger is a cue to action. It tells the user what to do next with some piece of information. So it starts with what's called an external trigger. An external trigger gives the user some piece of information like click here, buy now, play this. It could be a friend telling you about this great new app they installed that you should really check out through word of mouth. All of these things are examples of what's called an external trigger. Now, those external triggers lead to the action. The action is described as the simplest behavior done in anticipation of a reward. So something as simple as opening an app or clicking on a YouTube video or doing a quick Google search. All these things are examples of these very simple actions done in anticipation of a reward. So after the action comes the reward itself. This is where the user's itch is scratched, so to speak. And so here, what we find is that not only do habit-forming products utilize a reward, not only do they address the user's need and scratch their itch, but interestingly enough, they also use what's called a variable reward. So this comes from the classic work of B.F. Skinner, who showed us that when he took these pigeons and he put them in a little box and he gave them a disc to peck at inside this cage, what he found was that at first, when he provided the reward, the little food pellet that the pigeons received on a predictable schedule of reinforcement, so in other words, when the pigeon would peck at this disc, they would get a food pellet. And then what he basically could train these pigeons to do was to peck at this disc whenever they were hungry. But then Skinner did something a little bit different. What he did was introduce a variable reward. So sometimes the pigeons would peck at the disc and nothing would come out. There'd be no reward. And the next time they would peck at the disc, they would receive a reward. And it turns out that variability, that bit of surprise, that bit of mystery is in all sorts of products that we find most engaging, most habit forming, the things that that engage us and that we can't let go. These are the kind of products that use this element of mystery, this bit of the unknown. We see it in all sorts of products. It's what makes books interesting and what makes sports so captivating and what makes using an app or a game, what keeps us coming back again and again and again, is at the core this variable reward, this element of mystery and surprise. And then finally, the last step of the hook model is the investment phase. And this is probably the most overlooked part of the hook model. And this is where I think a lot of companies have some great opportunities to explore, because it turns out that it's not good enough just to scratch your users' itch, that if you want them to come back, you've got to find a way to get them to invest in your product. You've got to ask for some data, for them to produce some content, for them to accrue followers or reputation, some bit of work that they do, that they put into your product, which does two things. It loads the next trigger. So it's something that the user does to bring themselves back. So if you think about a messaging app like WhatsApp or Slack, it's the fastest growing messaging app. Fastest growing enterprise app in history. You know, these products, every time you send a message to somebody using this platform, you're loading the next trigger because you're likely to get a reply. And that reply brings you back through the hook once again. So the first way that these investments increase the likelihood of the next pass through the hook is by loading the next trigger and storing value. So one of the things that's so exciting about these technology products in particular is that, you know, unlike things in the physical world, like, you know, your desk and your chair and your clothing, all of these things depreciate with use, right? The more we use them, they lose value with use. But habit-forming products should do the opposite. That really the greatest products that we can't stop using, that we, you know, come back to time and time again, these are the kind of products that ask us to put value inside them so that they appreciate with time. They get better and better the more we use them. And so this is a really key principle. If you can find ways to get your users to make your product better with data, content, followers, reputation, that's a killer innovation. So there's lots of opportunities to do that in all sorts of ways. And then finally, so after we've made it through these four steps to the hook, it turns out that through successive cycles through these hooks, trigger, action, reward, investment, eventually we no longer need what we started with. What we started with was an external trigger. But it turns out that over time, we can cue the user to action, not with external triggers, not with these calls to action, but in fact with what's called an internal trigger. So that at first, maybe I'll start using Facebook or Twitter because I hear about it, or I see an email or a notification. But eventually, I start using these products because I'm feeling bored, right? Mm-hmm. Or maybe I'll check the stock market or news or sports scores because of this internal trigger that I've developed around boredom or seeking connection, or maybe I'm stressed or anxious. So it turns out these internal triggers are the core of how these products bring us back. It's when we form an association with the ways we feel, in ways that we don't even articulate that these things prompt us to action, but in fact they do. And that's the ultimate, that's the holy grail of these habit-forming products, is to create a mental association with these negative emotions, mm-hmm. with these pain points. So I'm lonely, I check Facebook instantly. I'm uncertain, I'm on Google with little or no conscious thought. Right. So these internal triggers prompt us to action without us really thinking about it.
Yeah. It becomes that snowball rolling downhill, picking up speed, taking care of itself.
Right? A little bit. Right.
Okay. So let me see if I can summarize this just for the everyday innovators and listeners. Of course, you can go to show notes and find more detail on this. And we'll talk about Nir's book in just a moment, too, on how to find that. But your model starts, the hook model starts with this trigger, which is the cue to action. The mm-hmm. action is a simple behavior that leads to the reward. And that reward addresses a user need, and we can heighten that experience by adding some mystery there. We'll have to look at some examples of doing that too. And then the fourth stage was that investment. So we're asking for some work, some input from the user to increase their engagement, and that leads us back to a new trigger to start the cycle over.
Right.
Fair enough.
You got it.
Okay.
Yep. Very good.
Very good. So now that we know what the model is like, let's try to make it a little bit more tangible by connecting it to an illustration. And we talked about one case study before, which you actually mentioned in your book. And I say when we talked about that, we talked about that when we were doing the pre-interview for this, which is a Bible application called YouVersion. Is that a fair case study for us to examine?
Sure. Yeah. I use that. There's lots of examples. Sure. We talked about, should we do a profile of Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or WhatsApp or Slack? I mean, there's so many great examples of habit forming products out there that keep us coming back time and time again. And we could also do offline examples like sports or books, or, you know, there's all kinds of examples of habit forming products that keep us engaged, that have hooks designed into the core of the product. But, you know, the YouVersion app is a great example because it's not one that people really think of as a habit-forming product. I mean, how do you make the Bible habit-forming, right? I mean, YouVersion, for those who aren't familiar with it, it's the largest Bible app in the world. I think, you know, when I wrote the book, and this was a couple of years ago, they had just topped 100 million installs. I know they're well over that now. And if they were a Silicon Valley startup, they'd be worth literally over $1 billion just because of how many people are engaged. Now, the company's a nonprofit. It's owned by a church, and they have no plans to monetize it. But it provides a great example of how this product made something like reading the Bible actually pretty habit-forming. Mm-hmm. And so we can walk through that by identifying first the external trigger. Well, the external trigger for the Bible app is that when you first install it, when you first use it, you're asked to start a Bible reading plan. And that Bible reading plan sends you a notification, which is a form of an external trigger, which provides you information for what to do. The information for what to do is simply open the app, which is the action phase. And they've made opening the app as easy as possible to do. You just swipe across your phone, boom, you're taken to the verse or the interpretation or some kind of text that you're supposed to read. They have all kinds of plans that you can follow. So the action is just to swipe across. Now comes the variable reward. Well, the variable reward is in the content itself. It's this rewards of the hunt of what am I going to find? What's the message going to be for me? And what I discovered talking to Bobby Grinwald, the CEO of YouVersion, what he told me was is that people really anticipate and are excited about what's the message that they're going to receive today. What's the verse that has been selected for them in the program? And so they spend a lot of time working on how to make digesting that verse as relevant as easy as possible. So they have it in all kinds of languages. They have it for youth. They have it, you know, in different text versions of the Bible, so that there's this bit of a reward. There's a bit of anticipation around, you know, what does this particular verse mean for me? There's some variability. There's some mystery. And in fact, actually, also those notifications don't always come at the same time. There's a great story that Bobby told me that because they vary when these notifications go out, talk about the variable reward. There's some uncertainty there. One person told the company that, he tweeted that the Bible. So this user was about to enter a strip club, and it turned out that the Bible app sent him a notification. Just happened to be, it wasn't planned, or who knows, if you believe in a higher power, maybe it was planned. Maybe it was planned. But it turns out that it just so happened that he received this notification from the Bible app to read his daily verse, a few steps from the strip club. And so he immediately tweeted, the Bible just reached out to me and told me not to go into the strip club. So talk about that variability. And then finally, the investment phase is, as you read these small verses, by the way, they're designed to be very easy to digest. They're, you know, they're very quick little snippets. And so as you read these portions, you begin to invest by identifying which plan you want to follow. After you read a verse, you've got this checkmark mechanism of, yes, you completed that version, and now you've invested a bit of your time and effort in your progress. So you see this little progress meter, and you get a check mark for every day that you've completed. That's a form of investment, right? You're giving the company data based on how frequently you interact with them that allows them to then load the next trigger next time that says, hey, you know, you missed one yesterday, or hey, you're on a streak and, you know, don't stop now. Or, you know, if we see that you need particular inspiration because you've left us for a week and you haven't checked in, maybe they'll send you, based on your data, a special quote that's likely to have a bigger mm-hmm. impact. And that's all done based on consumer data into the system. And so there's a lot of other examples of how they do this, but that's just the first iteration of a hook. And then over time, what they've seen is that through successive cycles of this hook, by passing people through trigger action reward investment, eventually people start opening the app on their own, right? The internal trigger of when I need some solace, when I need some comfort, when I'm feeling stressed, this becomes what people do, as opposed to other means that they might be able to provide themselves comfort. This becomes where they go instead from that prompting of the internal trigger, even without prompting.
Mm-hmm. So instead of walking into the strip club, open up the YouVersion Bible app, at least for them. So let me drill in on a couple questions that came up as you were walking through that. I'll kind of work backwards here. First, the variable reward. So that was, the example was the emails going out at different times. So there's creating a little bit of mystery about that and, you know, getting something maybe unexpected, at least from the timing perspective. Was that built into the application from the beginning, do you know? Or is that something that they discovered to add later?
You know, I'm not sure, to be honest. I'm not sure if they updated that later on or if that was in there from day one. I know that they are a very data-driven company. Mm-hmm. They drive a lot of what you see and when you see it from some of the data they've collected. I know that Google actually met with them. I talk about this in the book, that Google engineers came out to their little church where they run this app because they have such a huge audience to help them figure out ways to use the data they were collecting to increase engagement.
Right. Very good. And when it comes to those plans, so I'm assuming when I don't know the history of YouVersion. I actually have it on my phone and didn't know it was YouVersion until we started talking about this. I just know it says Bible app and I do use it. I just kind of missed that old branding part. My fault. But when it comes to the plans they have, I assume in the beginning, they probably had some small number of plans that they started with, right? Because the plans, it sounds like they address specific interests or needs. You know, do I need encouragement? There's probably a plan to help me, right, you know, find encouragement. Am I looking for wisdom? And there's probably a plan to help me with, you know, wisdom verses from the Bible. And I would imagine that that has grown over time, in part because of this investment from users feeding back information about what they were looking for.
Right, right. So that's exactly right. I think the plan, the Bobby's idea was we want to make this as accessible to everyone. We wanted everyone to be able to take the key action, which is to read the verse. And so his way of making the behavior as easy as possible was to make lots of different versions of the text and lots of different plans. And that's actually a lesson that if you think about, anyone in any business can implement, right? You don't have to be in the Bible app business to take a lesson here. I mean, this is a fundamental lesson. What can you do in your business to make the key behavior, to make the thing that you want users to do on a regular basis as easy as possible to do? I can't tell you how much innovation. I mean, if you look at the history of innovation, and I don't care if it's the cotton gin or the iPhone, the history of innovation in a nutshell is decreasing the distance between the recognized need and the solution. That's what technological innovation does. And so if you can be the person that removes steps from the process, if you can take out the effort of getting the work done to get my reward, and oftentimes that reward is on a psychological basis, right? It's comfort, it's relief from stress, it's relief from anxiety, it's connection with other people. I mean, these are deep human needs that need addressing. Mm-hmm. If you can reduce that distance between the recognized need and the reward, that's where innovation happens. That's where you should look to decrease the steps in your business, in your user flow.
Absolutely. So that notion of making the key thing as easy as possible to do, so the user does get that benefit of, you know, solving their need. But I can envision making products that do that, and then they stop there, right? And they don't do the extra steps of going through creating the cycle that really draws users in even more, continues to solve their problem, and creates that higher engagement.
Right, right. So you don't necessarily have to do all four steps. Like if you're a product that's bought once or twice a year, for example, mm-hmm. and you can't figure out how to engage people further, that's okay. You should still figure out, you know, the piecemeal lessons here of how can you use trigger action reward investment on their own, but you don't have to use all four of them. It's only if you have a product that needs to be used, you know, weekly or daily or intradaily, that's when you have this very high bar of having to create a habit, in which case you have to have all four steps. Because if your product is just not used that frequently, you're never going to create that internal trigger. You're never going to get all the way through the hook with sufficient frequency to create an association with an internal trigger. It's just not going to happen. You have to have high frequency. Mm-hmm. However, what you can do is to find ways to engage people more often. So let me give you an example. So I spoke at a conference in front of 700 real estate agents. And as right before I get up to talk, the person who hired me introduces me as a habit expert, and Nir is going to teach us how to make home buying and selling a habit. Well, the first thing I said when I got on stage was, you know, let me just be clear, home buying will never be a habit, right? That's never going to be a habit because it doesn't occur with sufficient frequency. And it's the antithesis of a habit. A habit is a behavior that occurs with little or no conscious thought. Well, buying a home is the exact opposite of that, right? You've got tons of cognitive thought, tons of thinking and debating and deliberating. So that will never be a habit. However, you know, I gave my workshop. I gave them the principles of the hook model in about an hour. And I asked them to kind of do some work during the talk to figure out how they might be able to use the hook in their business. After the workshop, one lady comes up to me and she says, I've got it. My internal trigger is going to be financial stress. Whenever someone in my neighborhood, in my community, feels financial insecurity about their kids' college fund, about their retirement, about the stock market gyrations, whenever they feel financial stress, I want them to call me. I want them to look at my website where I'm going to have lots of resources. I want to be their go-to. I want to create that habit of whenever they feel financial stress, because that's something that Americans feel every day, I want them to call me. So that, and this is the goal, this is the rule I want every one of your listeners to write down. The rule here is that monetization is a result of engagement. Far too often, we just go for the gold, right? Check out, buy my thing, give me your money. Whereas instead, if we figure out ways to create habits around valuable services, valuable things that we can provide to our customers that are very inexpensive, right? Building this relationship, like this real estate agent did, of the go-to source when you have financial stress and I can point you to the right directions, or I can give you my free app that can give you resources, or you can turn to my website that can help calm your financial stress. That doesn't cost very much. And that's something that users can do regularly. And you better believe that when that customer, when that person in her neighborhood does want to buy or sell a home, guess who they're going to call? Well, of course, they're going to call her. So even if your product is not something that's used every day, you can still find ways to build habits around. Maybe it's content. Maybe it's other services. What other value can you provide to your users on a regular basis so that when they actually do need to check out, you're going to be top of mind? It's the top of mind solution that wins.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and this is a very tweetable quote. So we should make sure someone listening gets this out. You know, monetization is a result of engagement.
Right.
And it's that notion, you know, those of us are involved in digital marketing of, you know, knowing, liking, and trusting the person that we're working with, right? And you build that relationship over time,
right.
And you need that engagement. And the example I was thinking of is you're going through that. I just had the experience of having a crown put on, and love my dentist. I actually did an interview with him that's on my website, Dr. Andrew Hall in Colorado Springs. And he's this phenomenal dentist that he does the work in studio in his lab and does this digital imaging that makes a model. And then they mill the crown for you in real time, and you get it all fitted and you're done in that one sitting, right? But it was the simple little thing that the next day he sends me a text message that says, hey, want to check in? How you feeling? Everything okay? And it was that, you know, not a habit forming kind of interaction, but it was a point of engagement that really made me think, gosh, you know, this is extraordinary service.
Yeah, exactly. And how simple is that, right? It could have even been an automated message. Who knows? It doesn't even matter, right?
Right, it doesn't.
It doesn't matter, right? But it's the fact that that he thought of a way to re-engage you, that your act essentially of going to him loaded the next trigger and provided him an opportunity to engage you again.
Right. Absolutely. So very good.
And now we actually live in an age, it's actually pretty amazing. I mean, before, you know, if your dentist was going to check in with you the day after, maybe a week after, maybe 3 weeks after, he'd have to do that himself. Well, now we've got all these fantastic tools that can automate this stuff for us, right? That this blend, I'm not saying you should go all robot, but there's this great blend of reaching out on your own, you know, personally, but then also using these tools that can automate a response that says, hey, you know, we just want to check up on you. How you doing? Mm-hmm. A lot of this stuff can be done, you know, programmatically.
Right. Yep. And then you deal personally one-on-one with the people that do respond.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Very good. So I don't know if we have time to talk about this other concept much, but I wanted to see if you could at least introduce it because I found it interesting in your book. Habit testing, right? So
right.
Kind of a take on user testing. And it's in the context, as I was thinking about it, was, you know, how can everyday innovators take their existing products and think about making them more habit forming with their users, with their customers?
Right. So habit testing is a technique that I picked up from talking to many of the companies I profiled in my book, like Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. Many of these products told me about this experience that they had where they weren't exactly sure what it was that customers loved about their product so much, because sometimes it's murky even to you, certainly to your customers. So what many of these companies do is this process of habit testing, which I wrote about here in the book, which is this three-step process of identify, codify, and modify. We don't have time to get into a ton of detail about it, but basically the idea is that if you have a product that's out there that for some reason a small percentage of the population loves and you're struggling to figure out how do I get everybody to love it, well, then what you do is you identify the weirdos, right? Mm-hmm. You go to those small percentage of users and you figure out what's unique about them. How do they use the product? And most importantly, how do they come to use the product? So what you do is you identify those people. That's those small percentage of users who use it, what you would call on a habitual basis. Maybe they use it every day. Maybe they use it once a week, however frequently you think is habitual use. Then you codify the steps that they took to start using the product. So for example, in Twitter's example, there's a famous case where they found that the people who love Twitter, who use it every single day, those are the people who in the very, I think it was in the first 30 days, followed 10 people. And so if you could follow 10 people, then you were much more likely to be one of these Uber users. So guess what? Today on the Twitter onboarding process, and this is the modify part of identify, codify, modify, everybody who signs up to Twitter has to follow other people right away, right? That's right. Part of the onboarding process of using Twitter.
Good example. And I've been on Twitter long enough to know that changed. And it used to be that I got the emails that would encourage me to, you know, follow other people. And now it's part of the onboarding process. Good. So habit testing. I also was thinking in terms of kind of raving fan testing, right? That if it's a product that's a little bit less habit forming, you could still do a similar sort of thing with your raving fans and understand what makes them the raving fans that want to stay engaged with you.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. If you can find what they love about it, what's unique about those people, you can sometimes transfer and make it easier to get to that reward for the rest of your user base.
Yep. Yep. And keep those rewards coming. Very good. Well, as my listeners know, I always like to wrap up interviews with an innovation quote. What did you bring us today?
Well, okay, so my innovation quote's a little weird. In fact, when I sent it to you, you had no idea what I was talking about. So my innovation quote that I actually look at every day, in fact, is eat the frog first. And eat the frog first is a modification. Nobody famous said that. It's a modification on a Mark Twain quote. And a real Mark Twain quote is, if it's your job to eat a frog, it's best to do it first thing in the morning.
Mm.
And if it's your job to eat two frogs, it's best to eat the biggest one first. And so the reason I remind myself of that is because there's actually a lot of research that shows that our energy is highest in the beginning of the day. That's when most people have the most energy, and it's very important to manage our mental energy. And I'm not talking about chakras or any kind of pseudoscience. I'm talking about, you know, our interest in doing our work for the day.
Sure.
So my principle is to always do the hardest thing first. That's what swallowing the frog first is all about. Like, do the thing that you don't really want to do, but you know is the most important thing you have to do in your day. Do that first. So for me, it's writing. So from 7:30 to 9:30 every morning, I need to be writing. That's my frog that mm-hmm. I need to eat first thing in the morning, because if I do email, if I do this, if I do that, then the writing will just get pushed off. So I eat the biggest frog first and I do it first thing in the morning.
Right. And the same is true for me. Writing is my frog in the morning. Those days I do write. And I'm curious if you found this to be true for yourself or not, because I know everyone has their different routines. I find when I write in the morning, I feel more rewarded afterwards than if I write in the afternoon or evening. I don't feel as rewarded when I get
totally.
It done.
And you carry it all day, right? Because now you've got that big frog in your stomach and you can enjoy that satiety throughout your day that you've done it.
Yeah, exactly. So,
right.
Very good. So really great discussion about the hook model. How can people follow up with you, follow your work, find your book, share that information with us?
Yeah, thanks for asking. The book is called Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products, and it's available wherever books are sold. And I blog at nearandfar.com, and near is spelled like my first name, N-I-R. So it's N-I-R and far, nearandfar.com.
Excellent. And Everyday Innovators, you will find that information also on the show notes, and I'll provide links to make it easy to get to all that. Nir, thank you once again for talking about innovation and creating habit-forming products with us.
My sincere pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Product Innovation Training your customers will love you for. To learn more, please check out the blog at theeverydayinnovator.com. Keep innovating.